My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Walter Hagerts, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we're talking about a very depressing topic, and that's the topic of the COP30, right? Walter, environmental protection, or the opposite of it, what humanity is doing currently.
Yes, Dario, hi. COP30 in itself is depressing because it's one of those international conferences that often promises a lot and delivers very little. But of course, the really depressing aspect here is the world that we live in and the complete absence of any political urgency to do something about the environmental disaster that we're already experiencing to some degree, but that's only going to get worse over the next few decades and century. COP30, unfortunately, is very unlikely to bring any help or remedy to this because COP29 and COP28 didn't do that either.
So I'm already going to apologize to the listeners in case the two of us are in a really bad mood today, which, based on the preparation for the episode, might be the case. We hope that we're not really raining on your parade, but at the same time, I mean, this is not really a topic to make anyone feel comfortable about, because it is kind of the existential question of our times. So I hope that the listeners are... Right, have some leniency on us when we start ranting in a few moments.
It's one of those things that it is, once you start thinking about it, and of course we have done other episodes about it, and it's been a major part of my adult life in the way that I, you know, the thinking about and reading about environmental decay, carbon emissions, all those things. It is just weird that the world is still sleepwalking through it, that the world is still acting as if it is not a priority, right? It is, and as if it's almost like a political position that when you say, I am deeply, not just concerned, but almost panicked about where we are when it comes to the environment and where we're going and the complete lack of serious action that's taken, that people shrug their shoulders and say, oh, that you are you such a lefty, or are you, why are you being so political? This is not a political position. This is a scientific position. There is enormous scientific consensus about the doom that we're heading towards, and we're acting like it's just one of many problems that we're facing.
I'm not sure whether I agree with you that we are sleepwalking. I would call the human behavior from, let's just say, let's say from the 1990s until 2015, I would call that sleepwalking, right? It was this thing of, oh yeah, the Club of Rome told us about climate change. Yeah, we had the Kyoto Protocol. Yes, it's an important thing, but you know what? It's far away. And then 2015, right, the Paris Agreement happens. And then you had the whole Fridays for Future momentum, where in all different countries, right, you had real climate policy being enacted. You had all these goals set that, oh, by 2050, 2060, 2045, depending on the country, we're going to achieve at least carbon neutrality. And right, so there was this little bit of momentum. But now what we're experiencing today is I can't call it sleepwalking. I have to call it willful ignorance. Because we've gone back, right? So it's not that nice feeling of 2010, you know, the World Cup was happening in South Africa and everyone was kind of happy and climate change is far away. No, we're already seeing the results. We were on a better path a few years ago, but we are actually going the other way. And we're saying enough of this whole climate change. We have to go back to the good old days when climate change didn't exist.
Yeah, it depends, I guess, on how you define or understand an analogy like sleepwalking. But the fact that there have been agreements made with targets set doesn't mean anything to me, right? I mean, setting targets is meaningless if those targets aren't met. And those targets that you're referring to that were set were never properly met. It's a little bit like Saudi Arabia's Vision 2030. I mean, nobody ever thinks that anything serious is going to come out of it. It's a little bit like the Millennium Development Goals. Hey, let's reduce poverty by 50% over the next 15 years. And then after 15 years, oops, we didn't do it. Well, let's set new goals. Those goals are, in some ways, I would almost say, a sleeping pill, right? They're a way to, we set that goal and then we can go to bed at night and feel comfortable about ourselves because we've set a goal. as if then half of the work is done, whereas not even 1% of the work is done by setting a goal, because then the actual thing actually needs to happen. And that thing that needs to happen hasn't happened. And I would argue that even at an individual level, people are sleepwalking through that. Because yes, ask your average person, certainly young people, certainly people your age or younger than you, they will absolutely say, I care about the environment. But at the same time, their consumptive patterns aren't being reduced, right? They don't say, okay, so the environment is in trouble. What can I do in order to, you know, at least not be responsible for any further disaster? Let's stop going on holidays that require flying. Let's stop consuming. Let's stop buying expensive technological products that I know are bad for the environment. No. People are not really taking any drastic action. So the fact that people set goals and say, I'm concerned about it, does not take the sleepwalking element away for me.
Yeah, I mean, I see that. And I still think that the momentum that we had a few years ago, where on the highest political level, it seemed like, right, people had noticed about the urgency. And I'm particularly thinking about 2019, right before the pandemic, right? Because this was when Fridays for Future was really strong, and all these global climate protests happened. And it also coincided with the European parliamentary elections in 2019. And Green parties all over Europe won big. And as a response, the Conservative Commission, right, with Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, enacted the European climate goals and really started acting on it. And then suddenly you saw this chain reaction of other countries also declaring, right, stricter and more intensive goals. So yeah, maybe there was a lot of empty words, but at least in 2019, and maybe I was young and naive, I had a feeling that the urgency was well understood, right? Because we already saw, and there was also just more focus on science, right? So we already saw the effects. We believed scientists. We believed scientists. And we saw some actual initiatives going into that direction. Whereas now, it almost seems like we've gone back to sleep. because it's the complete opposite of what we've seen before. I mean, no one is taking the COP serious at the moment. I mean, are we? Because it's no. What you said about COP 28, 29, 30. I mean, it's more like, who's even going this year? I don't know if there's a big name going.
No, and if there are big names still going, it doesn't really matter, right? I mean, there were some articles that argued that that it was a relief that people like Trump wouldn't be there. Yeah, I mean, okay, whatever. It doesn't really matter. I very much appreciate, especially you warned readers that we're in a bad mood because of this. I appreciate that you're trying to look at some positive moments, and because that is often then a guide and a path forward, right? See what happened when we were actually doing things correctly. But let's be real here. Even those moments that you're mentioning, those moments that certain targets were set, besides the fact that those targets were never met, so again, plans but never actually properly realized, but even if they'd been realized, they were nowhere near sufficient to what needs to happen. So when you say people properly understood it, no, I think that people generally understand there's a problem. They don't understand how big the problem is. They don't understand how existential, literally existential for ourselves, the problem is, right? So it's a little bit like me saying, I have this, I'm suffering from cancer. Well, I understand that I need to take a paracetamol. Well, yeah, that's very nice. It may take some of the pain away, but it's not going to solve the long-term issue, right? So I would never argue that people haven't at all expressed any concern about the environment, but we're nowhere near the levels of deactivity. We need to deactivate ourselves when it comes to the environment, right? We still display the exact consumptive lifestyles, the exact behavior from governments that you sold 10, 20, 30 years ago. And it's just depressing.
To support this with some numbers, 2025 was a global record when it came to CO2 emissions. I don't know if this number helps anyone put anything into perspective, but globally, we emitted 38.1 billion metric tons of CO2, which is an increase of 1.1% compared to 2024. So yeah, it's not even that humanity has reached a peak in CO2 basically production, and that now we're kind of going down, but no, the peak is still ahead of us, and only in the next few, well, the next like 10, 12 years are we expected to kind of decrease global CO2 production.
It's a little bit related to what in the preparation you said, like, hey, there have at least been some significant improvements in, or we have done better when it comes to deforestation. But that sentence itself already applies. We have been better in deforesting less, right? I mean, but we're still deforesting. We're still doing the things that are so destructive. So it's not even just about let's grow the plant for land back. No, let's first stop destroying things, and then we can talk about making things better, right?
Yeah. At the same time, right, so because we are the Western Bubble Podcast, let's look a little bit at how the West is doing compared to the rest. Let's just say that the United States and Europe, they are slightly improving on certain factors, but of course nowhere near what would be needed, particularly given that historically those are the biggest emitters out there, is that we are the ones who are responsible for the climate change we're seeing. And compared to that, I think it is interesting that China's CO2 emissions have been falling flat. Have been falling actually for the last 18 months. So there might be a possibility that China has actually hit its peak in emissions, and has actually hit that early and is now kind of cutting it down. But that is still to say, I mean, we should add that China is the biggest producer of CO2 emissions, also the biggest producer of things simply in the world, right? So that is kind of in line with each other. But at least there seems to be the correct trend, because and the next fact is that China installed 333 gigawatt hours of solar power in the last year. That's as much as the whole rest of the world combined. Right, so it's interesting to see that China seems to be taking climate change rather seriously. At least there's a state-led focus on this, and there are very clear targets, right, when it comes to clean energies and using that. While in the West, right now the conversation is more about, oh, maybe we were a bit too serious with the whole climate change topic. We might want to think about going back a little bit, because this is all becoming a little bit too much, you know, so much climate change, it's not healthy for us.
Exactly. It's interesting when it comes to China that it should be pointed out that, yes, in national terms, they are clearly the largest producer of CO2 emissions, no doubt about it. But per capita, they're, what was it, number 25 or something? They're not in the top 10, right? So because it is a country of 1.4 billion people. So in that sense, it's the West loves going on about how China is the biggest polluter, but many Western countries are higher up than that. Certainly the United States is, for example, right?
Which, I mean, that's actually, that was a dangerous part in our preparation, because the two of us fell down a little rabbit hole looking at these lists. Right, because of course the biggest polluters when it comes to carbon dioxide emissions by country is of course China, United States, India. I think we should count the European Union as one entity here, because otherwise they just come way too late. Russia, Japan, I mean those are right, those are the countries you would expect, and those are the countries that, I mean have to take on the big responsibility. But as you said, it does make sense to look at the per capita amount of CO2 emitted. And there, I mean, Western countries are not as high up, but that's because some of these other countries have some very specific circumstances. So, for example, a lot of the Gulf countries are, of course, high up here, Qatar, Kuwait, Bahrain, or the UAE, because as oil producers, right, it kind of fueling global demand, and with this, because I mean there is a big discussion actually in the global climate discussion whether you should look at CO2 production on within your borders, or basically how much CO2 production you have caused. Because then, for example, it would be different with regards to China and the West, because the West is demanding a lot of products that are coming from China, and that are then being used here, right? So those are interesting discussions, but let's not get into them today. But so there's a lot of Gulf countries that are very high up in the list of countries by carbon emissions per capita.
Yeah, and so there are then all kinds of ethical questions, moral questions related to that. But from an analytical perspective, the question is, okay, so if you want to do something about all of this, what is the way out, right? If I was a citizen of a Gulf state, I would scratch my head and I would say, hey, there's a problem because I'm actually really, really bad for the rest of the world in what I who my country is bad for the world in that sense. That's a moral issue. But if we say, okay, what needs to be done in order to reverse all of this, then looking at Kuwait or looking at Saudi Arabia is not that useful, right? We need to look at the actual underlying large mass causes. And then you look at consumptive patterns of the economically developed world. You look at the fact that we simply consume too much. We simply want too many things. We want too many holidays, too many houses, too many cars, too many clothes, too many everything. And that, interestingly enough, then also connects CO2 emissions to all kinds of other forms of environmental degradation, right? Because CO2 emissions is not the only problem we face. We're basically just abusing the planet way more than it can handle in the long term. And the only real conversation that you can have out of these numbers is let's consume less. Yes, there are efficiency gains. Yes, we can have solar energy. Yes, there are loads of things that we can do to improve our planet, or at least to stop destroying our planet. But at the core, it is about consumption.
It very much is, and there's a few countries that are really bad when it comes to that. And this is a rabbit hole that we fell into. Palau, right? Small island in the Pacific has the highest CO2 per capita emissions in the world. And the two of us basically fell down this little rabbit hole because I mean, what is Palau doing that we don't know about? Or do they basically produce all the coal energy that the United States is using? And here it is, of course, important to mention Palau is a very small island, so overall their total CO2 emissions don't really impact the world that much. But the explanation is that it's a small island in the middle of the Pacific, and a lot of and basically almost everything they need needs to be shipped there, or even transported by plane. And yeah, that was just a very interesting side fact. I think our listeners would appreciate too.
Which, by the way, should also make you scratch your head about billionaires who live on their yachts or their islands, who also need everything shipped to them, right? Basically, there are these kinds of patterns, lifestyle patterns. And, hey, if you're a baby born in Palau, you can't be blamed for being born in Palau. But there are loads of aspects of our lives that cause us to do things that are inefficient, that are potentially destructive. I always find it interesting to compare energy and electricity consumption in a country like Spain to that, for example, of the Netherlands, where in the Netherlands everyone wants their house, which is more difficult to heat, with a garden. Even though the Netherlands is a very small territory, everyone wants a little bit of space for themselves. Whereas here in Madrid, for example, everyone just lives in apartments, which is way more efficient when it comes to heating, when it comes to also just economies of scale, right? From a production perspective and from a supply perspective, it's much easier to supply a city like Madrid than to supply Amsterdam or to supply other Dutch cities. And so there are all these kinds of questions that need to be tackled, but all of them lead to human beings at some point needing to make some sacrifices. Dutch people need to give up their little gardens, for example, but they're not willing to do that.
I mean, because to support what you say, let's look at the other extreme example we found, and that's the Faroe Islands. Because you would think, okay, they're in the middle of the Atlantic between Iceland, the UK, and Norway, so they must have a similar CO2 per capita ratio. But no, they're actually second last in the world, right? Just above the Democratic Republic of Congo, where there are different reasons why what countries are down there. That it's more, much more tied to development. But with the Faroe Islands, we then did some research because again we're too little nerds when it comes to that type of stuff. And there, it is more about the lifestyle, right? That people on the Faroe Islands are kind of living very much based off what they have on the island. Their economic activity is very much connected to fishing, to sheep, and to all these other things. But they have similar living standards to us, which, I mean, so it is possible, right? It's just really about what you said, and that is consumption.
And that's interesting. So you're born as a baby in Palau, and you do not have a culture and an environment around you in which you are, beneficial, or at least not, you're going to be destructive for the global environment. Whereas you are a baby in the Faroe Islands, and you grow up in an environment that is naturally more balanced with the environment, right? Naturally more in line with what the planet can actually sustain. And that in itself should be something that we all study and that we all think about, right? Where is my imbalance? Where what kind of things am I so used to getting, to doing that actually make me a destructive force for the future, for my children, my grandchildren, and all that. And once you go down that rabbit hole, once you go sort of start studying which society is just objectively, statistically less destructive than other societies, then the immediate conclusion out of that will be we should emulate those societies. We should try to become more like them. Now, we can't become the Faroe Islands if you live in Germany or if you live in Spain, but you can at least learn lessons from that. Unfortunately, those lessons would require sacrifice. It would require us to change things that we are way too used to because we all grew up believing that certain levels of luxury and consumption were just our birthright and we should not have to do anything, especially if we can then tell ourselves it's big industry and it's the billionaires that are the only ones responsible, right?
Yeah. In case anyone wants to learn more about the Faroe Islands and why they're so, right, what's working there, and we found a lovely paper that we can only recommend to all of you. We haven't read it, but we've read the title, and that's enough in today's world. And it's titled "The Social Metabolism of Quiet Sustainability in the Faroe Islands." If you know what social metabolism is and you can explain it in a sentence, please send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, because despite minutes of intensive research, we still don't really know what it is.
I tried to go through the Wikipedia page and I read the words and I understood every single word, but I didn't understand the words together. I didn't understand the sentences or its meaning. So please, please enlighten us.
But now that right now that we've lightened the mood up, let's shoot it back down. The current COP infrastructure. Right, so the fact that we meet once a year somewhere else in the world, and a bunch of people take airplanes there and are celebrating how much they're saving the environment on a daily basis, for also 2 weeks, it's based on the Kyoto Protocol from the 1990s, and that's interesting, right? Because it was the high point of kind of global cooperation, also the high point of the West. However, the COP conference is, I mean, its infrastructure is based on these ideas from the 1990s, but they no longer work in today's world because we are no longer living in the 1990s. We're living in 2025, where all those lovely ideas that Fukuyama may have had in the 1990s are gone.
And it's interesting because in the introduction, earlier on in this episode, you essentially said, hey, since the 1990s, we've been sleepwalking. But there is something that was the case in the 1990s that allowed us to actually start this, right? So we have known, I mean, there are newspaper articles from the early 20th century, right? And there are scientists from the 19th century who are already warning where we have a problem when it comes to CO2 emissions. When it comes to just general environmental degradation. But certainly from the 60s and 70s onwards, we scientifically know the problem. During the 70s and 80s, the world was caught up in a Cold War environment, and they didn't really have much time to think, or they didn't want to think about environmental degradation because they were worried about nuclear holocaust, about potentially destruction of the world through World War III. The 1990s were a decade in which all of a sudden everything seemed great. You mentioned Fukuyama. And so all of a sudden there was this space to actually say, okay, yay, we're happy now. We can relax. We can sleep properly at night because there's no longer any nuclear threat pointing at us. Let's start thinking about how we can make the 21st century the best century ever. And in that environment, all of a sudden, you see a lot of climate initiatives. Now, they weren't sufficient, even if they had been carried out. But there is all of a sudden a flurry of activity saying, okay, what needs to be done in order to become sustainable? What the UN has all kinds of panels. Companies become all of a sudden environmentally, I won't say friendly, and less destructive. There's all kinds of conversations about this in the media, in the news, about the environment, because we have time to think about it. On top of that, you still have this enormous Western dominance in geopolitics, where the West can kind of set the agenda, right? They can say, hey, we now, as the West, care about the environment, so everyone else has to care about the environment. We don't have to compete with anyone else. Follow us or you're in trouble. And so if you want to trade with us, if you don't want to be invaded, be good. And make sure that you have some kind of green energy policy or something like that. Now in 2025, and also 15 years ago, the world has moved to a much darker place in terms of psychology. We are much more concerned about day-to-day things. We don't believe that the 21st century is ever going to be this brilliant, wonderful century that in the 1990s people thought it would be. And so we're kind of back to that Cold War scenario where people have more immediate fears and concerns, and the environment seems to be like an annoying, unpleasant thing that doesn't affect you tomorrow, so why think about it?
Unfortunately, I do feel that on a day-by-day basis, because as I mean, I've told the listeners before that I work for an energy efficiency organization in Germany. And that means that actually usually I'm quite positive about climate change, because all day long I'm in my little bubble with people who are thinking about how can we become more energy efficient, right? What type of machines do we need? What type of business models could we have to basically decouple our economic growth from energy consumption, which, by the way, Germany has done, right? So the German economy for the last 25 years has been growing despite the fact that our CO2 our CO2 emissions are going down. And so it is definitely possible, not to say that in order to achieve what we need to achieve, right, to basically keep global warming below 1.5 degrees, it needs more than just to decouple growth from it, right? I mean, that's something that we've been saying throughout the entire episode and before, that it just needs radical change. However, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately for me and my personal development, a few weeks ago, we stepped out of our little bubble and we actually stepped into the heartland of the German industry, right? So we met with, or basically we went to the yearly conference of the very energy intensive German industries. So those are companies, about 300 of them, and they combined make up about 15% of German energy consumption, right? That is an enormous amount. And so for us, it's obviously very interesting because we can tell them things about energy efficiency. Energy efficiency is usually not a very controversial topic, right? Because everyone kind of understands that, you know what, if you use less energy, that means you have fewer costs, and that means that you have higher profits. Great, everyone likes that. However, at that conference, I actually realized that we were not seen as like reasonable people that care about German industries and about the jobs, right? And about making sure that we can kind of, right, keep the social fabric together, because a lot of the German social fabric is based on everyone is wealthy, more or less. No, we were actually seen as absolute enemies. As people who are trying to take the German industry down and are basically environmental hippie clowns who do not care about them at all.
And do you have experiences from previous years that contrast that? Is that something that changed this year compared to what 2 years ago or 3 years ago would have been the case?
I don't. I mean, my boss told me that, hey, it's not super unusual. However, I clearly felt... right, so like the overall sentiment is not unusual. However, the self-confidence with which at that event people were saying completely outrageous things, and also right just openly on stage, right in front of hundreds of people, basically really important politicians invited to give keynotes, and then they were like, okay, well, now we're going to tell you off because your policies, right, your environmental whatever policies have been ruining the German industry. The sentence, it's been enough environmental protection now in these last few years. We need to make money again, and we need to become serious again about the German industry. That sentence was uttered on stage, right? And was echoed all the time in like direct conversations. So the confidence is certainly a different one, right? Where, and that's kind of what I meant with 5 years ago, there seemed to be a consensus amongst everyone that, hey, this is the most important topic, and let's deal with it. And the conversation was more about, okay, how hard are we going to make this on ourselves? And now the conversation is actually back to the fundamentals, right? It almost seems like it's back, it's 1972 again, and the Club of Rome has just published its report, and people are still skeptical that this environmental stuff is really that serious after all. And if you ask me, I think they are very much emboldened by, at least my analysis of the situation is that they are emboldened by what they're seeing in the United States and what they're seeing based on the events in the United States, in Germany, right? That it's not only a Trump who's publicly saying that, you know what, environmental protection is donezo, and we're just going to continue like, oh, actually, we're going to go back to the old days. But also that is being echoed by the German conservatives, for example, right? Who kind of ran on that campaign to say that no, this environmental protection nonsense is just destroying our economic foundation.
So it's being seen as something that is essentially a voluntary moral choice rather than an existential practical necessity to do something about it, right?
I wouldn't even say like a voluntary moral choice. That it's more like, oh, your people just want to feel good about yourselves. You don't know anything about reality. This is just to make you feel good, but this is not the real world, right? So it's actually turning it the other way around.
So there are then a number of things that are coming together here, because of course the German economy has been struggling, and so all those managers, all those directors are feeling the squeeze from their shareholders. Profits are not there. They're under enormous pressure to show the profit. They're not under pressure to save the planet. They're under pressure to basically provide dividends to their shareholders. But on top of that, we also live in a populist world these days where essentially the idea of basic scientific consensus and basic human decency are no longer something to be celebrated, right? It's no longer there as a foundation of everything else. A well-functioning society needs to say, here's science, here are the facts, and based on that, we need to make certain choices. And here is a fundamental social contract about how we interact with each other and how we care about each other and what we do with each other. And those two things have been completely collapsing in front of our eyes over the past 10 years or so.
And that's something that I experienced in almost every single personal conversation I had that day. Right. So first of all, we weren't talked to at all. No, when I say at all, we weren't talked to that much. Right? People kind of were like, oh, the green hippies, basically. So they ignored us. But some people did approach us. But you could tell that they approached us with a mindset of, oh, you know what, I'm gonna tell them my opinion. I'm gonna tell them off for basically destroying the German industry. And in these conversations, that's exactly what happened, right? So they would say something along the lines of, right, oh, so I've, one second, I do have to provide some context. One of the main things that kind of the German energy efficiency industry is advocating for, and one of the easiest ways to save energy is an energy management system, right? So just that you basically have data points of every single part in your company or in your factory and all the buildings, and you have an understanding of how much energy you're consuming at every corner. And it is a simple fact that after implementing an energy management system, most like on average, companies and buildings reduce their energy consumption by 20%, right? That's a fact. We know that. And we also know through surveys that were not done by us, but they were done by the government, right, of these companies, that despite like after these initial savings of 20%, every following year, each come like the companies on average save an additional 3 to 4%, right? So this is not like a one and done deal. This is like it gets better every single year. And on top of that, right, the last number I'm going to mention is that 75% of companies, after having implemented these systems, because they were usually forced to by regulation, they say, even without the regulation, I would continue using this system, but I kind of needed to be forced first, right? Because a lot of them were skeptical of them beforehand, right? So these are the facts. These are like scientifically established facts, right? So it's through surveys and through studies from universities. So those type of facts I would drop in personal conversations. And then the answer I would receive is, yes, but I'm not feeling that and I'm not seeing that in my personal surroundings, right? That was the answer. And I thought to myself, am I in the United States? Am I in Trump land? Right? Completely losing hope. And then so each time there would be like, I have my felt facts, my alternative facts, basically. I would respond with, oh, but here, the data shows this and the data shows that. And what you're saying is, right, of course, you try to avoid telling people that you're simply wrong. You're trying to kind of guide them towards the truth. That particular conversation that I'm quoting from right now was finished with, well, at some point, your energy management fascists will learn that that you're on the wrong path.
I thought you were green hippies, but now you were fascists all of a sudden. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the scale of basically insults I kind of heard that day ranged from fascism, all right, on the right, all the way to energy efficiency, planned economy, right? So to communism. So that the whole scale is there.
Well, just to be clear, and these policy examples that you mention are show this, and you mentioned it previously. But just for anyone who's still in doubt, you are not some kind of green lobby group. You are there to help industry transitioning to more efficient, better energy, green energy. Right? It's got nothing to do with you just waking up one morning and saying I want to save the planet. It is very much about how can business profit from this? How can business become more effective because of this?
Yeah, right. So we represent 250 companies that provide energy efficiency products or services. So yeah, we represent the part of the German industry, right? It's about 1 million jobs. And it's actually one of the few areas of the German economy that's growing at the moment. So screw you, all the others. And of course, we do this because this is a really important part of the energy transition, because Germany, believe it or not, used to be world market leader in all kind of energy transition technologies, right? So solar and wind, energy efficiency. However, because of the government under Merkel, actually, the solar industry, right? All the technology was sold off. Guess where? It was sold off to China, and China now has the best solar panels in the world, and actually also the they managed to scale it so that they're also the biggest producers. And the wind industry was just completely taken apart by really unfriendly regulation towards them. And so in the wind industry alone, in the last 10 years, they killed 80,000 jobs, right? So we're not even at the point any longer where we're making the moral argument, right? So we're not saying, oh, you should do this for the planet. No, we're saying that you should do this out of very selfish reasons. You should do this because it's 1 million jobs, because it's significant economic growth, because it will just make your business more profitable, right? So we're telling these businesses, hey, you can make more money, and you who used to be, well, no, who still is very dependent on Russian gas, and now that you no longer have Russian gas and you need to buy expensive Qatari gas, and therefore your profit margins are down, and therefore you're feeling the pressure, and therefore the economy has been stagnating, you could overcome this through innovation, just invest in new machines for which you even receive subsidies, and then you are also less dependent on foreign actors, right? Because Qatar could also turn off the gas supply tomorrow. I mean, if I don't know if you criticize the country for whatever, right? So we're making economic, we're making security arguments, right? We're making job arguments, but even that. Right, even selfish arguments are no longer working with these people, and that to me was really, really like it dawned on me how much we're screwed.
And on top of that, that innovation that you mentioned is essential if you as an industry want to stay relevant over the next 10, 20 years. But of course, as we know, the next 10, 20 years are no longer that important from a German business perspective, because you have those pressures from shareholders about the next quarterly report, rather than what happens in 5 years down the line or anything like that, right?
Yeah, and before this turns into a criticism of capitalism again, I mean, the super positive examples that we also, right, that I usually encounter on day to day are those, are those that are family owned, right, or that are privately owned enterprises, because they do not have any shareholders who care about the profits, but it's usually those families, right, who kind of think in, they don't think in the next 2-3 months, but they think in the next 3-4 generations and say that, no, if I want, first of all, if I want my kids to live in a livable planet, then I have to do this. And if I want my company to remain relevant, then I definitely have to do this. So with them, because it's always, right, it's a little bit schizophrenic almost, because you're talking to these business owners, are usually old white men, right? And so based on the stereotypes that you would have, you would think, oh, okay, this is going to be a difficult conversation. But those are the biggest environmentalists out there, right? It's actually a lot of fun talking to them, despite the fact how conservative they might be.
Well, and it's interesting. I liked your little sentence before we criticize capitalism again, as if every episode we're criticizing capitalism. We've noticed.
We do, well, lately.
But I think we're both also on the side that there are potentially at least lots of good things coming out of capitalism that wouldn't exist in non-capitalist systems. Communism doesn't work. We've tried it. Didn't go well in the 20th century. But there is, of course, a strong argument that if you look at China, and China can also make mistakes, right? China does a lot of things that are bad, that don't work well for the environment, for example. But the problem with the kind of hyper-capitalism that is now visible and that you don't see in those family businesses that you mentioned is that there is a disconnection between the pressures on directors and the actual value of the company, right? If it's your company, even if it's a large company, but it's a family business, you attach pride to that company and you actually care about whether in 5-10 years time it's still going to be relevant. You still care about the reputation coming out of it. You don't want your family to be tainted by some kind of immoral practices. You want to innovate. You want your staff to, in the long term, not have to be fired. All those kinds of things, right? Whereas the kind of hyper-capitalism, where I think partially that conference or those conversations that you just mentioned come out of, are no longer at all interested in those kinds of factors. They're not interested in the long-term sustainability of the company. They're not interested in the long-term reputation of the company. What they are interested in is that they are going to be fired if in the next 2 years they don't make a certain amount of profit. And that's where capitalism becomes very ugly. And that's where, again, China can be much more effective. Because China can say, Chinese business, start investing in solar energy. In the beginning, that's going to be costly. We will subsidize you. We will help you. But if you don't do it, we will punish you. Something that in Europe, you know, in Europe, there's more of a carrot than a stick these days. But in China, there's very much still a stick as well. And therefore, from a authoritarian, centralized perspective, they can transform markets if they believe that makes sense. Capitalistically speaking, economically speaking, financially speaking, over the next 10, 20 years. And that's where Europe and the United States have a huge problem, because hyper-capitalism is too short-term, making themselves irrelevant in the long term.
Right, that's very funny, because I have an anecdote from about 2 weeks ago, during a political event. I was talking to a former minister of the economy for Germany, right? Also a close ally of Angela Merkel, his name is Peter Altmaier. For the Germans, he was, let's just say it was late, and he may have already had like a few glasses of wine, right? And he's retired, so he also has the luxury of he no longer needs to watch what he says. And he was basically echoing exactly what you just said, right? So he said that while he was economic minister, he had all these German tech companies and the like the farmer sector, right? He had them all together at a round table, and he told them, hey, everyone, Germany is a really old country. We already have too few basically caregivers, right? We don't have enough personnel, and it's very expensive. And technology will be able to do this. You should invest right now in these robots that can basically help people, right, in their daily life, so that they can still live at home, right, and it would solve a lot of problems. And this is going to be a big thing because we're an aging population on the planet. And then he kind of said, yeah, but they laughed me out of the room. They didn't take me very seriously. And guess who now, and because I don't know if you've seen the videos or if our listeners have seen the videos, of basically some of the first robots coming out. And yes, they're still very clumsy and still very bad, but it kind of shows that people are working on this. But which countries are the ones that are innovating in that area? Well, it's China and Japan. And that's exactly what he was saying. It's like, and now people are complaining once again about, oh, why are all these other countries kind of having these innovations and we don't? And he said, I told the German industry, and I'm not some nobody. I was the minister of the economy back then, and companies wouldn't listen to me.
So if he had been
That's the carrot right there.
Exactly. But if he had been minister of the economy in China, and there has been a counterpart clearly in China basically saying exactly this, then he would have been able to kind of impose it. Say, hey, here's the carrot, here's the stick. But because...
Choose wisely.
Exactly. And let's face it, nobody can accuse him of being anti-capitalist. Obviously, he's not. But the problem is that capitalism only works if there are certain limitations to how far the profit motive can go. And right now we're getting to a stage that a profit motive is not a problem. It's one thing to say, hey, over the next, economically speaking, economic theory says that companies maximize profits and therefore they won't do anything to endanger their future. Well, now we're at a stage that they do lots of things that endanger their future, because the people responsible are no longer thinking about 10, 20 years. They're thinking about next year, and therefore they laughed them out of the room. And that is the thing where the West really needs to get a grip. They need to start understanding that there are limits to what business can actually achieve without at least some soft guidance. Exactly what you see in Europe in the 20th century, by the way, right? Let's not act as if that's completely alien to us. This is what you would see in Germany in the 1960s, in the 1970s. This is exactly what you expect in the Netherlands or in France or even in the UK to a certain extent. But that has now gone completely out of the window. And then you get all this bunch of rude managers that call you names. Because they don't like your message, because they believe that your message actually is giving them a headache, because the next quarterly report would suffer if they follow your recommendations.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com. Also do that when you know what social metabolism is, or if you have any other funny anecdotes about the climate. Thank you very much for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side, Balder. Which closing quote did you pick for us today?
I will promise that if someone sends in a good explanation of social metabolism, that will be my quote next week, just as a carrot. My quote is from the famous Limits to Growth report that you already referenced twice in the episode from the Club of Rome, 1972. By then, we kind of knew, they reported on it, but the world knew that we were in serious environmental trouble. This is 50 years ago, over 50 years ago, and they wrote this report. And the quote that I have, it almost makes me a little bit sad, because they were hopeful, and this quote shows their hope. And they talk about that it is obvious, otherwise their grandchildren would suffer. Now, we are the grandchildren, and we are suffering already. It's not something in the future anymore. We know the consequences of environmental degradation. We see it everywhere around the world, and it's only going to get worse. But those grandchildren, us, still haven't woken up to it. So their hope seems to be in vain. The quote goes, "We believe this report will cause a growing number of people throughout the world to ask themselves in earnest whether the momentum of present growth may not overshoot the carrying capacity of this planet, and to consider the chilling alternatives such an overshoot implies for ourselves, our children, and our grandchildren."